If I were advising President Trump, I'm not, but if I were advising him, I would say, don't go to Vietnam.
As President Trump announces the dates and place where he will meet Kim Jong-un, not all agree he should go. It's Thursday, February 7th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, what would happen if U.S. troops are drawn out of Afghanistan? You'll hear one expert's opinion. A new report explores how a drawn-out trade war could badly hurt both China and the United States. And some mega companies are pushing for greater recognition of indigenous people in Australia. U.S. allies have given a cautious welcome to the announcement of a second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to be held in Vietnam later this month. The U.S. leader also said during his State of the Union address Tuesday that peace talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan must be given a chance. And he pledged to pull American troops out of costly wars. Henry Ridgewell reports on global reaction to a speech widely seen as light on foreign policy.
President Donald Trump announced he will meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late February in the Vietnamese city of Da Nang, the latest milestone in what Trump claimed as a major success of his term in office.
Nuclear testing has stopped. And there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months.
South Korea welcomed the summit announcement, but called for specific and practical actions to be agreed upon. Seoul is taking a cautious approach, says U.S. policy analyst and author James Boyes.
I would imagine that there are many people in South Korea who are concerned at this point that perhaps Donald Trump might continue that withdrawal process and talk about bringing American troops home from the Korean Peninsula in exchange for any nuclear agreement.
To gasps from some in the audience, Trump said America would likely be at war with North Korea had his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton won the presidency in 2016. His claims of success in negotiations with Pyongyang are disputed, says Leslie Vinjamuri, head of the U.S. program at policy group Chatham House.
There's still evidence that they are committed to their nuclear program.
Trump repeated his pledge to bring American troops home from costly wars.
We have spent more than $7 trillion in fighting wars in the Middle East. As a candidate for president, I loudly pledged a new approach. Great nations do not fight endless wars.
He added that Islamic State had been largely defeated in Syria. But there are growing concerns among allies over an American withdrawal from long-running conflicts, says Chatham House's Leslie Vinjamuri.
As to whether you can really rely on the Taliban to deliver on any peace settlement that might be agreed, certainly a lot of concern by women in Afghanistan of what that would mean. And again, he's, you know, same line that he's going to pull America's troops out of Syria. And there's a very grave concern there about what the implications of that will be for stability in Syria, for ISIS, the threat from ISIS, whether that will grow.
Separately, Trump criticized Russia's purported violation of a Cold War-era missile treaty that both Washington and Moscow have pulled out of in recent days, and warned that without a new agreement, the U.S. would outspend and out-innovate all others. Again, analyst James Boyes.
It's notable that he was very critical of European leaders, NATO allies, claiming that they've had to be dragged kicking and screaming to pay their share of the defence expenditure, for example, and yet spoke quite warmly of people like President Xi, for example, from China.
Trump was referring to the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. The US vowed to withdraw from the treaty in 6 months unless Moscow ends what the US calls violations of the landmark 1987 Arms Control Pact. Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier Moscow will start working on creating new missiles, including hypersonic weapons, and told his ministers not to initiate disarmament talks with Washington. With little new in terms of U.S. foreign policy, the impression from afar is the State of the Union address was aimed at addressing Trump's challenges at home. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As we continue, you'll hear from a former high-ranking U.S. State Department official who has some issues with the planned second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAAsia.com. High-level talks between the United States and China are set to resume next week in hopes of ending an escalating trade war between the two economic superpowers. Police in Indonesia discover almost 200 Bangladeshi migrants crammed into a shop house. The men hoping to travel to Myanmar for work are believed to have been living there for several months. A report by the United Nations shown to the Security Council Friday claims North Korea is working to ensure its weapons cannot be destroyed by military strikes. And an Indonesian court has sentenced a British woman to 6 months in jail for slapping an immigration officer after overstaying her visa. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. We continue now. You have heard President Donald Trump announce that he'll hold a second summit meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un later this month in Vietnam. Not everyone agrees that such a second meeting should take place. One such person is Nicholas Burns. Professor Burns served in the United States government for 27 years. As a career Foreign Service officer, he was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008. Burns is now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He explained his stance when he spoke with Joan Lee of the VOA Korean Service. As you will hear, the conversation took place in a crowded, somewhat noisy room.
I don't think President Trump was tough enough at Singapore. We suspended our military exercises, and that gave the North Koreans an inducement, a favor that they didn't earn, because the North Koreans have not even declared for us so many months after Singapore. What is the extent of their nuclear apparatus? Where are their nuclear weapons? How many do they have? What type? Where is their fissile material? They haven't even taken the first step in the negotiations, and we've made these fundamental compromises. So I think from a negotiating point of view, I think the president's been too lenient. And I also think it's very important that we have a very tight integration with South Korea, with President Moon. And frankly, we need to keep the Chinese close. And when President Trump returned from Singapore, you remember he tweeted out, the nuclear problem has been resolved. That allowed China and Russia to begin to trade again, because the American president said the problem has been resolved, and it had not been. So I think that the president has not been a skillful and not been a tough-minded negotiator. I hope he will become that, because while I support diplomacy, we need the North Koreans to make some more significant declarations of what they plan to do with their nuclear program and how they're going to restrain it and hopefully at some point eliminate it.
I mean, do you believe Kim Jong-un's intention that he will completely give up all of his nuclear weapons and delivery systems, all of that? I mean, is that a realistic goal?
It's not a realistic goal. No, I think that my sense of the North Koreans is that they are very happy to have a diplomatic dialogue where the pressure on them is lessened. And they establish themselves as a credible power in the world, as an acceptable power. I do not believe that Kim Jong-un will give up his nuclear weapons, because I think that he sees them as his insurance policy for regime survival. So I don't think that he will.
I mean, does that mean that we kind of have to change our objective at this point? Maybe, you know, a little softer objective, you know, preventing them from having ICBM, you know, that's a direct threat to the United States. I mean, what is a realistic goal then?
From a negotiation standpoint, I'm a former State Department diplomat, and I, you know, teach negotiations of international politics at Harvard. I think it would be a mistake for us to suddenly say, oh, we'll accept a North Korea nuclear program. It's an unacceptable program to the people of Japan and to most South Koreans, a threat. And certainly it's unacceptable, it would be unacceptable, should North Korea achieve the capability to fire a nuclear warhead at Washington, D.C. or
Kansas City or Los Angeles. And so I think, frankly, the president should maintain the posture that we believe that North Korea should dismantle all of its nuclear weapons. That should be the goal. And that we need to ask countries around the world, like China and Russia, to help us achieve that. Why would we concede this point to Kim Jong-un? They have an illegal, under international law, under the non-proliferation treaty, and illicit nuclear program, a secret program. The world deserves to know more about this program. So I think we should stick to our principles here.
I mean, President Trump has been criticizing, the strategic patience of North Korea.
Yeah.
But it seems like now he's kind of patient.
I fear that President Trump is too focused on kind of the symbolism, the pageantry of a summit meeting. And that's what he really wants. President Trump wants a summit. He wants to say, I'm resolving the problem, but he's not resolving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
He's not being truthful to the American people about resolving the problem.
Do you believe there may be a progress out of the second summit that's going to be taking
place? My view is, if I were advising President Trump, I'm not, but if I were advising him, I would say, don't go to Vietnam unless you know ahead of time the following concessions will be made by Kim Jong-un. If you are able to establish that he's ready to make those concessions, declare all of his nuclear weapons, fissile material, then you go. But if he's not ready to do that, don't go. Don't go twice to summit meetings and get nothing from Kim Jong-un.
This is VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, Pakistan's top court Wednesday warned the military and intelligence agencies they must not exceed their mandate and meddle in politics, an apparent rebuke over their handling of Islamist protest in 2017. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us here on VOA Asia. President Donald Trump included the possibility of peace in Afghanistan during his State of the Union speech Tuesday night.
In Afghanistan, my administration is holding constructive talks with a number of Afghan groups, including the Taliban. As we make progress in these negotiations, we will be able to reduce our troops' presence and focus on counterterrorism, and we will indeed focus on counterterrorism.
But that possibility has drawn doubt among quite a few experts. I asked Benjamin Hopkins, Director of Asian Studies at George Washington University in Washington, about his reservations.
I think there's long been a need to engage in peace negotiations. I think the problem with the current administration approach is that I don't see the fundamental calculus of the Taliban as a potential peace partner changing in terms of what they want. It seems like the only party that's changed their attitude is the United States under the Trump administration, and the real change has just been a desire to get out.
Are you saying that you just don't trust the Taliban?
I don't think the Taliban's interests have changed, I guess is how I would characterize it. I don't think their public statements or their public interest in terms of what they are seeking, which is essentially a withdrawal of American troops, has changed. I think if there's been a shift in the party's positions, it's been the American willingness under the Trump administration to withdraw from Afghanistan.
How much do you think Donald Trump, the president of the United States, wants those troops out as opposed to what might happen if they do go?
I have not seen any public statements from the administration indicating that there has been a serious discussion of what happens afterwards in terms of if the United States were to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, what that would mean, number one, for the Afghan government, but number two, for American interest in the region. Now, those conversations could be taking place privately behind the scenes, but there's not been a whole lot of movement in terms of administration policy in this region that would give me a lot of confidence in those conversations happening.
If U.S. troops did withdraw, even a partial withdrawal, how do you paint, what kind of picture do you paint for Afghanistan?
Well, the security of the Afghan government, the security and viability of the Afghan government, as presently constituted, is dependent on the continuation of an American troop deployment in the country. I think almost every observer and commentator would recognize that. And I think most importantly, the Taliban recognizes that. If the United States were to withdraw completely, I think that would put significant question marks over the viability of the Afghan government.
What about the refusal of the Taliban so far in any of these so-called peace talks to talk with the current Afghanistan government?
I think this is a big problem, and it also shows where they believe, quite correctly, the power militarily in the current situation to lie, namely with the United States. And I think the Taliban has always believed and continues to believe that only with the United States out of the way can they militarily defeat the Afghan government. As long as American troops are in the country, they cannot win an armed conflict. But getting the United States out of the way, out of the country, would open up that possibility, especially with regard to a pretty weak Afghan government.
That's just a continuation, then, of what's happened in Afghanistan for centuries, right?
No, I wouldn't say for centuries. It's definitely a continuation of what's happened over the past 18 years. I mean, part of the problem that the Trump administration has both inherited but doubled down on is a lack of clear objective for the United States. There has not been one enunciated since shortly after the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Neither the Bush administration, nor the Obama administration, nor now the Trump administration has clearly articulated a war aim and purpose in Afghanistan. And it's very hard to declare objectives met and thus a victory won when you don't have a clear publicly acknowledged aim that you're fighting for.
Benjamin Hopkins, Director of Asian Studies at George Washington University here in Washington. Coming up, the trade war could result in the U.S. and China hurting the most. This is VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said that Wednesday there are no plans yet for President Trump and Chinese President Xi to meet soon in hope of finalizing a trade deal, though Mnuchin plans to travel to China's capital next week to continue the negotiations. You are listening to VOA Asia. There is a new UN report that warns the U.S.-China trade wars will negatively impact international trade, with the two economic superpowers emerging among the biggest losers. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva about the launch of the report by the UN Conference on Trade and Development.
U.S.-China trade discussions are underway. If no agreement is reached by March 1st, tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese goods will increase from 10% to 25%. A new UNCTAD study warns the repercussions on international trade will be massive, leading to a downturn in the global economy and instability in commodities and financial markets. Pamela Koch-Hamilton is director of UNCTAD's Division on International Trade in Goods and Services and Commodities. She says small and lower-income countries will suffer, as their exposure to external shocks will make it very difficult for them to maintain any level of resilience.
Stagflation, leading to job losses and higher unemployment, and more importantly, the possibility of a contagion effect, or what we call a reactionary effect, leading to a cascade of other trade distortionary measures, because everybody then will get in the game, and it will be very difficult.
The study predicts higher tariffs will trigger currency wars and devaluation. It warns the impact on global value chains and intermediate suppliers will be devastating. For example, the UN report says the relocation from East Asian value chains will result in a reduction of almost $160 billion to the region. Coke Hamilton says the retaliatory tariffs imposed by the United States have not achieved their intended effect. She says they have not resulted in increased domestic production, but rather will lead to a diversion of trade to third countries.
If the tariffs rise to 25%, what will occur is simple. They will limit trade from China. However, it will not be effective in protecting domestic firms. So suppliers in the rest of the world will be more competitive. Trade diversion effects in favor of third countries.
UN economists say the European Union will emerge as the biggest winner, capturing about $70 billion of U.S.-China bilateral trade. They say Japan, Mexico, and Canada will each capture more than $20 billion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here is a news alert from VOA Asia. A new report by the United Nations claims North Korea is working to ensure its nuclear and ballistic missile capabilities cannot be destroyed by military strikes. This confidential report, first disclosed by Reuters news agency, found evidence North Korea is using civilian facilities, including airports, for ballistic missile assembly and testing. We continue on VOA Asia. Australian mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP are supporting greater Indigenous recognition in Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Andrew McKenzie said the company, like the nation as a whole, has unfinished business with the Indigenous peoples of Australia and that it cannot stand on the sidelines. Critics, however, believe it could be a cynical move by the mining sector to gain favor with tribal groups, which have lands rich in natural resources. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
BHP and Rio Tinto are supporting a campaign to change Australia's constitution to give a formal voice to Aboriginal people in federal parliament. The mining giants employ thousands of Indigenous workers and are backing a demand from community leaders called the Uluru Statement from the Heart, made in 2017 for a special Aboriginal body to advise Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Officer Andrew McKenzie said the reform would empower Indigenous people and would boost the reconciliation process.
We now have a chance to create a new chapter in our history. Create a voice that will establish a bridge across that gulf. Now, I know there are fears that a constitutionally enshrined voice, confirmed by referendum, will deepen cultural divisions and is undemocratic. I don't think those fears stand up to scrutiny.
BHP will contribute about $700,000 to a project raising awareness about the benefits of an Indigenous voice to the Australian Parliament. Many of the company's operations are located on or close to Indigenous land. BHP says it acknowledges the right of First Australians to maintain their culture, identity, traditions and customs. But there is scepticism about the company's motives. Jacinta Price, an Aboriginal councillor in the central Australian city of Alice Springs, believes the miners' support for constitutional reform is a superficial move.
We need to have a bit more of a discussion. I don't know that just simply throwing your support behind something that we're not sure what that actually looks like is helpful. And in a way, perhaps it is a way of these companies to look better in the eyes of Indigenous people, considering it's Indigenous people's land that, you know, they want to be involved in.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has rejected the mining giant's push for greater Indigenous rights in federal parliament. He said he was focused on practical measures to help Aboriginal communities. Indigenous people make up about 3% of the population, but suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook, our email as well, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and the VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.